So, welcome everybody to a slightly different show. You might detect that this is a man speaking, and my name's Tom Evans, and I'm speaking tonight. I'm taking the show host slot over, and I'm turning the tables on the goddess Lillian, and she's our guest tonight. So, welcome, goddess Lillian.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for having me a few weeks ago. We've had quite a tumultuous time since then, haven't we? A wonderful time. Just to fill everyone in on this, is that I was a show host back in June, and then we spent about an hour on the phone after that just having a chat about you and your business. And all of a sudden, all this amazing stuff just poured out of you about your knowledge. And I asked a very innocent question of, have you ever been on your own show? And you said, no. And has anyone ever interviewed you about your stuff? And you said, no. And I said, I just threw the gauntlet down and said, well, let's turn the tables and see what happens. So how are you feeling tonight?
I'm actually quite grateful that we're doing this, and also quite nervous. I guess now I understand what some of my guests actually go through, because normally I'm always in control. I have questions. I know what's going to come up. Everything's going to be fine. I'm the one who's showing everyone that it's going to be totally okay. But tonight I'm like, I don't know what's coming. So
well, listen, let me let you into a secret. I don't know what's coming either, right? And I'm probably about as nervous as you, because imagine the trust of someone handing their show over to you. How many months have you been running it now?
I've been running the show for almost 2 years. In November, it will be 2 years old.
Okay, so you've run the show successfully for 2 years, and all of a sudden, a man you'd never met, we're going to meet for the first time in person next week, right? A bloke you'd never met, you hand your treasured show over to, and I could just come out with complete rubbish tonight, couldn't it? But that's not going to happen. So let's wind back a couple of years. You know, before you started this show, what was the inspiration behind starting it? What do you want to achieve?
Well, when I started the show, funny enough, it was part of therapy, and a lot of people didn't realize this. I was actually petrified of speaking in public. I would rather have jumped into the River Thames than speak in public. And I decided that part of my life mission was actually working with public, speaking, coaching, training, doing different things, but it would actually involve me speaking in public. And I felt that this was part of my way of dealing with it, because I go, okay, if I could manage to deal with me speaking on the show, no one would see me, I would have guests. So it's very kind of, I'm still safe. No one can throw tomatoes at me. It was kind of good. I would have enough time to also get used to my own voice, because I was basically very, what's the word? I did not like my own voice. So I had to basically get used to my own voice, hearing my own voice. And this was the reason why I started the show, because it was going to help me go down my own personal journey.
Okay. So when you do your shows now, you're still nervous, or is that side disappeared now, and you're very confident about it?
Well, you know what? It's so funny, because I've been doing the show for almost 2 years. I now even teach part time. I do different things and do different sessions and workshops. I still get very nervous, and that won't go away. It's just part of my psyche, because it's that energy in me. But once I start speaking and I get into my rhythm, I'm totally fine. And it's funny, because I get really amazing people on the show that just make me feel, when I'm talking to them, I just feel so relaxed talking to them. So it's just always a pleasure and fun for me to do.
Well, you know, they say that a little bit of fear is kind of the adrenaline rush that you need to get up and perform anyway. And even apparently Robbie Williams gets scared before he goes on stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people. So I think it's probably quite a good thing. But obviously, we're turning the table tonight, and we're talking to you. Just before the show started then, what sort of stuff were you doing that led up to you running the show? And what was your sort of, what's the potted history of Lillian, I guess?
Well, it's so funny. Before the show, I was actually doing something that was very everyday. I worked in project management, but in between working in project management for banks, I always had, if we scroll all the way back to when I was in high school and quite young, and, you know, in fact, going back to me being 9, 10, even younger, I'd always had a passion for mythology, and I'd read everything I could get my hands on. I remember a couple of times getting locked in my library at school because I was always passionate about learning. But I was always passionate about learning about mythology and the things behind mythology. And it was like opening a doorway to another world for me. And so in between all that, doing my work in IT, living a normal life, as I will call it, I discovered that I'd always had passions for working with women and discovering why we did things, who we really are, and who we were when no one was looking. And so slowly things started to evolve, so I kind of ended up here.
Wow. So we've titled the show, haven't we, the Unlocking the Secret of the Pantheons.
Yeah.
And for people that are listening, can you just explain what a pantheon is?
Oh, that's very simple. A pantheon is basically what the science, if you want to classify a mythology family. So you have the Greek pantheon, you have the Roman pantheon, you have the Nordic pantheon. So that's all the gods and goddesses under one family. So that's how you did it to define the pantheon. And so when we talk about pantheons, my favorite one actually, I have a few favorites, but growing up was the Greek pantheons because you had Zeus, Hera, you had the whole Poseidon, and you know, watching how everything unfolds. And it's basically, when you think about the pantheon, just think dysfunctional family. If they had Jerry Springer in that time, they would be on Jerry Springer's show. I'm serious, because the Greek pantheon had tragedy, it had comedy, and it had a lot of things in between, but it was a way that people actually connected with different stories to make them better.
So where we've been brought up, certainly I was brought up a Roman Catholic, and I was taught at school that there's like one God, and then any thought of, you know, mythology, I think I probably came across the Nordic pantheon first, and then when I did Latin and that sort of stuff, then we came across some of the looking into derivation of Latin, the Greek gods and that sort of stuff. But how can we have this system where we've got one God, and how can the multiple gods kind of work into it? How does that all hang together?
Well, you see, I understand the whole idea of one God because I'm brought up Catholic. And, you know, when I never questioned it growing up as a child, and reading into this and reading the mythology and really enjoying it as a story. And I think there was a time I was reading up Genesis, and I remember seeing a part in Genesis where it talks about God's own sons marry mortal women and giving birth to what in the Bible is termed as immortal sons of God who were the heroes of stories of old. So when I read that, I was like, I wonder if all the great stories of the heroes, which make up all these pantheons, because that's where those heroes lie, could have been from that idea and that ideology. Now, there are some people that will say, well, that can't be, and, you know, I'm not here to make you question your religious faith. I am not here to determine whether it's true or not, or whether you actually believe it. But what I want you to do is suspend your disbelief for a moment and listen to the pantheons and stories and the way that we tell them and understand what we use them for. It's a way of making the unconscious come conscious so that you get to see it outside of yourself. And when you can actually embody, see a story embodied somewhere else, it makes more sense.
A bit like a parable or something like that in the Bible.
Wouldn't
that be similar sort of thing? So I want to explore the mythological side of this, but before we do that, let's just explore a little bit. You mentioned then it doesn't have to be real, okay? And we can get benefit from it by imagining that it might be real. We'll explore that in a bit now, but what if it was real? Well, how would that manifest itself? And how would that fit into all of these one God religions?
Well, imagine if it was real for a moment and one God religion, and the fact that each pantheon, you know, wherever you go, there seems to be a different pantheon. How about you thought about it this way? That it wasn't different gods. It was one set of gods. So basically the Greek gods, the Roman gods, the Nordic gods were really one set of people that basically, because we are all we all break down into our different tribes, we get the stories told to us back in names that our tribe will recognize. I mean, like the Greek and Roman mythology, it makes me laugh because you have Zeus. Zeus goes from Greek to Rome, and he goes through, you know, from Greek to the Roman mythology. And I call it, they just go through passport control and immigration, and they get a brand new set of names. They don't even try to style it out too much. Zeus, Jupiter, Aphrodite, Venus. And you're like, okay. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really change that much. And sometimes they want to try and confuse us and switch up your role of what they really did. But essentially, it's really the same god because you have Poseidon and Neptune. Gods of the sea. You guys look very similar. Okay, so in, you know, the Roman gods will be pictured with no beards. The Greek gods will have beards. And I'm like, so if we want to bring it back to this ideology of it being, you know, of that one god religion, it's the same family just being retold into different ways so that our tribes can recognize that.
Gotcha. So when you talk about beard, no beard, that's because the Greeks wore beards and the Romans didn't, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, gods made in our own likeness and we sort of modeled them on who we were. So would it be say that, are they now sort of more, are they transmodified into angels and archangels?
Well, I wouldn't, now for the fear of offending anyone, I wouldn't want to put them into angels and archangels. But what I'll say is, you can actually use them, like you said, as parables, or even just basically take them for what they are, stories. For you to get to see behind something. And the way we use them and the way I use them is simply this. I use them to deconstruct the archetypes, because when people talk about archetypes and they get Carl Jung's theory going, and a lot of it confuses a lot of people because it sounds really heavy and intense. And I just basically use the gods and goddesses as a pantheon to actually break that all down so that people get to see these archetypes at play, in almost like in the flesh and in 3D, because we get to remember things that actually stick with us and things that we actually feel connected into, which is why these archetypes actually work.
Gotcha. So let's assume that they're not real, but they've got this benefit there. So how would you go about establishing what someone's archetype is, and then how would they use that knowledge?
Well, normally to actually determine your archetype, we will sit down and have a conversation, and, you know, we could do it two ways. One, a set of online questions that you have to take and fill in, and with certain answers that you will come back to, which I'll then determine a basic archetype structure. Or the second way is having a one-to-one session with myself, and we will run through different scenarios, different setup, and different conversations. And we get to understand the different archetypes. Now, here's the thing, and I want to stress this, is that even though we may have certain archetypes in our makeup that we are more aligned to, There are also other archetypes that will be working alongside. So there's no hard and fast rule that you're this all the time. So once we determine, then we can say, okay, now you can understand how you get to play at home with your loved ones and how to be with your loved ones in a way that is actually in your best interest, in your loved one's best interest, for, as they say, for the highest good. And how you can be in that workplace and still be in your own center and deal with the other people without feeling like you're giving away your power or feeling disempowered. So really and truthfully, this is just a way to get you feeling very centered in yourself and very turned on to people around you and how you are interacting.
Okay, so that's anyways, then if I extrapolate this a little bit, if I know your archetype, And that gives me a kind of insight into the way that you behave and the way you react and what excites you and what might annoy you. And you know my archetype and you know all of these things that correlate to that. Surely we can have a much more meaningful relationship and conversation.
Exactly. And now imagine that taken into a personal relationship when you're working and you know the person that you're dealing with, his archetype. And, you know, her archetype, so you know exactly how to approach her, how to, you know, okay, this is what I know. Oh, I know she's slightly upset because of how I reacted to something. And it will make relationships a lot easier. It would actually make even dealing with children, because children are their own archetypes. and you know how to deal with things. And so we don't kind of lump everyone into one bucket of, oh, you're this, and you know, you must behave in this way, because we stop projecting our archetype on someone else. And that's where disagreement comes across.
Mm-hmm. And then if you extrapolate that up one level again, so instead of just a relationship between two people, you've got a group of people, let's say a team of people in business.
Yeah.
Then if everyone knows their archetype and knows where their strengths are, doesn't that make the team more powerful?
Exactly. It will make the team more effective, more productive. It would actually allow more for a more creative environment to actually flow, because everybody would be working from their places of strength. You can actually, the manager will know, well, he knows how to deal with his staff based on who they are, who they truly are, instead of who they pretend to be when they come into a workplace. And this way, people are more inspired. And when you have more inspired people in the workplace, what can I say? You actually create magic. I mean, look at Google. Google is one of those places that inspires people to be at their best. Disney inspires people to be at their best. And, you know, when you create that kind of environment where people can actually be at their best, well, in the end, will only increase productivity, which in translate to more profits in a business sense.
Wow. And I guess then all these modern-day profiling systems like Myers-Briggs and DISC and all this sort of stuff, they must be somehow based on the archetype.
Yes, they definitely are. They all have different elements of working through. You know, when we, you know, doing the Myers-Briggs, it will sometimes come out with people are, extroverts or slightly introverted. It's all based on type, and that typing of a personality, and it's taking the personality and actually unlocking it. So it's like unlocking the personality DNA. Now I go one step further to kind of anthropomorphize that personality in a person, so the person can actually see it as an external thing. So it's not just something that is flat and they get an idea of it. It's something that they actually get to communicate with. They get to actually see it in 3D, almost a 3D ideology, and say, well, this is an archetype of mine. I know when I'm doing this. I know why that's coming up. And they get to be more familiar and be more in control.
Okay, so I think I'm ENFP or something like that. I can't remember what I am, but I don't exactly resonate with that. It doesn't really inspire me, and it's a kind of useful bit of information, but it's kind of a bit dull and flat. So we now sort of take this modern day profiling and wind all the way back now. We wind back through Myers-Briggs. Someone told me once that Myers-Briggs was based on Jungian archetypes, and someone else told me that Jungian archetypes are based on tarot. And then you wind right back to the Roman gods, the Greek gods. Then you dropped into the conversation that we had after we had our chat on the show that there's an African pantheon, which I've never heard of.
Oh, yeah.
Is that then the root, then, that the Greek pantheon was based on?
Well, if you take if we wind everything back to the very beginning and saying that life begins out of Africa, then yes. It winds back all the way, but, you know, and like I said, it's breaking things down into tribes. So, you know, and it's funny, when people think of Africa, they think of it as one collective, but it's so funny that, you know, the Kemetic archetypes are different. So you have the Egyptian archetypes, and it's whenever I mention Egyptian archetypes, people are like, oh, yes, Osiris and Isis, and I'm like, yes, and I get this very blank look at it. Expression on your faces. I'm like, well, there's a lot more to Egypt than Osiris and Isis. There's Gib, there's Tefnut, there's Tot, there's Mat, there's, you know, and there's so many different things that at play, but it's still the same, you know, the same story kind of unwinding and rewinding themselves at play. Then a friend of mine just asked if Ramses is not an actual, he wasn't a god, he was a pharaoh. But yeah, Ramses would have taken on the Eye of Horus, which is, you know, which gives him lineage to the throne, because the Egyptians believe that for you to be on the throne, you're a physical representation of God. Now, and that being said, at, you know, when you move away from North Africa, where Egypt is, you move into West Africa, you know, there's so many, because in Dahomey they have their own archetypes. That's just in West Africa alone. The Ghanaians have their own archetypes. The Nigerians have their archetypes. And let's take Nigeria as a country, because that's where I'm from, originally as in my parentage. Nigerians, the Igbos have their own architectural structure. The Yorubas have their archetypal structure. And I've had the pleasure of just reintroducing myself with the Yoruba archetype. And that itself has so much depth to it. And so even in one country, like Nigeria, they have it actually breaks into different stories. Because again, going back to the tribes. Yeah, you know, so that's a different thing. And so in Africa alone, there are so many different pantheon stories in there that is just such a great place to actually discover.
Gotcha. Now, I was very fortunate that through Twitter, I met this lady. I met this lady in inverted commas called Amy Palkin up in Scotland. I've never met her physically. And about 18 months ago, and this is the time where I'd never really heard about any of the archetypes, I heard through this lovely lady called, I met her through a lovely lady called Jackie Walker, introduced me to her. And she said, oh, you know, get your archetype done by Amy. So she did some questioning, and she came up with my Greek archetype. And I was surprised that it came up as Hermes, but it gave me a lot of focus. Because, you know, I'm a writer and a writing coach. And it gave me a lot of focus about the stuff I was doing. And what I did, I thought, well, if that archetype is in me, I'll kind of look at every situation to see how I can exercise that archetype. And I think that my creativity and serendipity seem to jump up by about 400%. So how could knowing that about my Greek archetype get deeper and give me more insight by knowing the root of the Hermes archetype in the African pantheon?
Well, the Hermes archetype is basically, let's first of all look at what the Hermes archetype is. First of all, let's look at Hermes. Hermes is best known as the messenger of the gods. Now, Hermes actually was a lot more than that. He was actually also a negotiator, because he was the only one that was able to go into Hades, to go into Tartarus to negotiate with Hades the release of Persephone. So he not only delivered messages, but he negotiated on behalf of the gods. He delivered the messages to mortals, and also his own messages as well. But Hermes also became a master of transformation, where he was able to transform items. So he was able to, not just items, but physical reality. So Hermes also had the alchemist type in there. So Hermes possessed a lot of different archetypes. So he was a messenger, he was a negotiator, but he was also an alchemist as well.
Gotcha. So going back then into the Egyptian and the African pantheons, has Hermes got, does he correlate with them pretty much one-to-one, or is it split in some way?
It's split in some way. Now, with the Egyptian, with Hermes, I would say that is Thoth, because Thoth, that's an Egyptian. Thoth was the messenger of the gods, and he, you know, and he also negotiated with other gods, and when there were issues that needed to be discussed, it was Thoth that they went to. And he will then go back and deliver messages. So he was pretty much the messenger. And then the alchemist part of Thoth, the alchemist side in the Egyptian mythology, was Khnu. And his work was to actually create and mold people and mold things into reality. So there's so many different ways of looking at it, where in Hermes it's just one, you know, you can fit all of that into Hermes, but in the Egyptian there were different gods to actually apply for different ways. Now, in the Yoruba pantheon, Hermes' counterpart will be Eshu. Eshu delivered messages, and he went on not only delivering messages, but he also had another aspect to his archetype, where he was also the trickster, because he would test people's faith, test people's courage by, you know, putting obstacles in their way, and, you know, sometimes being deliberately, challenging to people to determine how much they wanted whatever it was that they required of the gods at the time. Or sometimes it was also his job to punish if he felt that the person did not honor the gods in the right way. So that will be Eshu. That will be Eshu's role. And so he was also the messenger of the gods as well.
Ah, so that Eshu character, he's the sort of person that would come on someone's show and then turn the tables on them and make them the interviewee as opposed to the interviewer, then, wouldn't he?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what Eshu will do.
Oh, that's so funny. Listen, you are just a mine of information. You know all this stuff. So can we let the listeners into a bit of a secret about the little plan that we're hatching here?
Sure, let's let them in.
Yeah? Which is another issue type of thing to do, to throw the gauntlet down. Because we did a little bit of research on Amazon, didn't we, about books about various pantheons. And there's nothing written about the African pantheon at all. And
no,
that correlates into, you know, all the other pantheons and into present day. So this is what you're planning to do at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, I'm actually working on writing a book on the pantheons and highlights the Yoruba pantheons, because there's not a lot of information out there, and for whatever reasons, we'll leave that alone at this point. So yes, I am working on this book. And, you know, it was so funny because my own archetype showed up when I started working on this book. And one of my archetypes that showed up was the saboteur.
Ah. And what's she or he called in the African sense?
I've yet to find who actually would hold this title, because I can actually give Eshu some of that role, because, again, that testing of how badly you want something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and even you can actually even call, if you look at it in the Egyptian side of it, you might actually use Set, because Set was always looking for trouble. Set was always looking for how to get into somebody else's business and destroy them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
we've also got something lined up tonight, because this is, and now you mentioned about this this Hermes issue character. I wasn't just content, was I? Just turning the tables on you, and saying, yeah, would you mind if I talked to you about the subject? But I said, well, how about if we got someone live on air, and you kind of archetype them up, so people could listen to what the process might be. And I believe is Amber kind of hanging around in the host queue?
Unfortunately, she's not yet on the host queue. So, and I've been trying to check if she's.
If Amber's listening, that's your cue to come in. If not, then we'll play another game, which will be kind of interesting. But while I'm waiting for Amber to turn up or not, and that might be part of one of the challenges tonight about getting all the technology working and stuff like that. How would you go about archetyping like a whole entity? So does a business have an archetype as well as a person?
Okay, let's look at a business as an archetype.
Yeah.
Now, let's take News of the World.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they ain't in the news anyway. We might as well look at them.
Yeah.
And the News of the World, let's look at the News of the World as an independent being.
Yeah.
And the archetype of the News of the World right now is that of the destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it does, it comes along and it kind of in its wake, it leaves a path of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people think of, well, yeah, people think in this thing as a destroyer archetype, that must be really bad and it's all negative. And you know what? No, it's not. It's not all bad. It's not all bad, because we need those destroyer archetypes. When they're doing the right job, they uproot things, they expose things that need to go, what need to change. And over 160, and how many years on News of the World was in position,
yeah.
It functioned, it exposed things that needed to be exposed so things could change, you know, things could be brought to light. And that's why the destroyer archetype, we all from time to time would experience, where basically it comes in like a tornado and sweeps the house, and it takes everything with it, whether you're ready to let go of it or not. Now, if we're going back to the News of the World, and then we crack open the News of the World ever so slightly, we can then say, okay, looking inside of the News of the World, of the people inside of it, we can take Rupert Murdoch as an archetype of his own. and he will be a king. He will be a king archetype. And, you know, people, well, a king is someone who's in charge and who's leading, you know, leading the way. And, you know, basically that's the, you know, the helm, holding the helm, holding the court is what a king is. And that is obviously something very positive. Now, yes, but no. Because when a king is actually what I call out of flow or in his shadow self, he is basically a control freak. He is controlling. He despises to have his authority questioned, which is very clear with, if you look at how Rupert Murdoch reacted to being called into Parliament, being questioned, you know, he was just basically, what's the word I'm looking for? He was just unapologetic. He was, you know, even when he did that apology saying that this was the humblest day of his life, I think the only thing that was actually humble about him was the word humble.
Mm.
You know,
so is it possible if you got a Rupert Murdoch, obviously he's a little bit set in his ways and he's in his 80s and stuff, can you change your archetype and can you adopt a different cloak?
You can adopt different types of archetypes, because when you become aware, and this is about the introduction to self, when you become aware of who your archetypes are, you get an idea of what you're doing and how it influences the lives of others around you.
Right.
And when you become aware, you can then look at the other archetypes that are at play. Because remember I said in a little bit earlier that we are not just one archetype. We have so many different other archetypes at play with us. So you can then start to draw on those other archetypes as well.
Gotcha. So obviously there's another level to this again, isn't there? So you could say, well, if my archetype doesn't seem to work in certain situations, what other mantles can I adopt and what other strategies can I take on board to deal with the situations?
Exactly. And you can take that into consideration, that there will be other things that will come up and show up.
And something else I'd like to explore is how these archetypes have leaked into our culture. So, you know, all these Disney films that are coming out and all the cartoons we see, the Tom and Jerry's and the Scooby-Doo's and the Sergeant Bilko's and all this sort of stuff, I didn't realize that archetypes are all over the place in them.
Oh, yeah. Our entire society is constructed in archetypes. Our entertainment is archetypes. I mean, we have watched TV since, you know, and every movie and Hollywood show would turn up and present us with an archetype. Now, we can look, start with, you know, pick something. I mean, I'm a fan of Disney cartoons. I'm a fan of cartoons, and I see archetypes in there, and I'm a fan of Hollywood, so I'll let you pick a movie or pick a cartoon.
Okay, I'm going to pick the Jungle Book.
Jungle Book. Okay. So the Jungle Book. So let's see. Let's go to the Jungle Book. The Jungle Book starts with an orphan in the woods, in the jungle. And so that is an archetype. It's funny that an orphan is an archetype under the child archetype. And before I go into this, some of the archetype structure that has been classified and some of the great work that has been done has to, some of the honors has to go to the amazing Carolyn Miss for some of the work on archetypes out there. I will be remiss if I didn't say that. So now the Jungle Book is an archetype. And in that whole essence, Mowgli is an orphan.
Yeah.
And Mowgli is an orphan, and he bumps into Baloo, the fun-loving jazz dancing bear, and Bagheera, the, you know, very serious leopard, who basically, you know, he is just tired of Baloo's shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
And those two turn out to be Mowgli's guides throughout the show.
Okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
They're his guides, and they're aspects of Mowgli. And what they both do is protect and guide Mowgli.
So who else is in there? Oh, tell me about the Monkey King. Who is that guy?
The Monkey King, you see, the Monkey King is, first of all, he's also an archetype. He is a king, and he's ruling this band of unruly monkey kingdom that are basically thieves and hooligans. And again,
he's Rupert Murdoch, and all his friends, they're all the journalists at the News of the World.
I will say yes, and hopefully they're not listening, so I can't do it.
I'll just say, allegedly, he's like Rupert Murdoch, and allegedly like those hacks at the News of the World.
Allegedly, exactly. They're allegedly like that. And so leads them on this merry dance, and the Monkey King basically wants, he basically wants what Mowgli has. So again, there's another archetype at play where basically this need to possess them. And that's also actually sometimes that's a king in itself and a shadow self where you believe you're entitled to everything, a sense of entitlement, because, you know, to be king, one has to be born into it. So in your shadow self, you see yourself in a sense of entitlement.
Okay.
Now then there is Shere Khan, Shere Khan the tiger. Shere Khan is the destroyer. Mm-hmm. He's basically death. Walking, and with him comes chaos, comes strife, and they're all, you know, and all under that, all under Shere Khan is basically he wants to exert his influence, which is to destroy the orphan. And again, it's also almost that is an aspect that Mowgli has to face up to, that Mowgli has to find himself, find the warrior within him to face Shere Khan. And that's really what that journey is from the to go from orphan to warrior to defeat the destroyer.
Yeah.
And along the way is basically his two guides. And, you know, and Disney shows him the music of, I want to be like you, who shoot it up. And just again, it's going and the dancing. And the, but all that aspect is the movement and being able to, it's, for Mowgli to be in touch with his aspect of his guides. And then there's the snake. The snake in itself is the hypnotic creature. And it's people are going to think of this in a very odd way. The snake is the seducer, the enchanter, and it's trying to seduce Mowgli into forgetting his mission, forgetting his purpose. And to become a victim, to go into victim state, because the snake wants to devour the orphan.
So what in our lives then, how does the seducer manifest itself?
The seducer has always manifested in movies. And let's take it out of the cartoon into actual, you know, big screen movies. The whole concept of the Hollywood siren is built on the seducer, the enchantress. Marilyn Monroe is one of the great seductress and enchantresses that lived and walked. Then you have Eartha Kitt, where that sensuality is used to sway, change, coerce the man, the hero, to either protect, to do bidden, to whatever it is. Basically, the seductress can overwhelm the hero. And the seductress hides, and this figure hides in every woman. And now when people think, okay, yep, that's the movies and everything, but how does the seductress and enchantress show up at work, and how is this a good thing? Well, the seductress or the seducer can show up in work, where they're able to use your words and in such a way that you buy into their side of an argument, especially seducers make great negotiators.
Gotcha. Right. So you might be a salesperson or someone like that, or it might even be that it could be a thing, not even a person, it could be procrastination. So, you know, I speak to a lot of authors that struggle with getting that solid writing time, and they seem to be some busy fools and do everything else, serving everybody else and helping other people out and getting on Twitter and getting on Facebook and doing everything else but writing their books. So is that a sort of macro level, the seducer coming in?
That's actually part of the saboteur coming in.
Oh, okay.
You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, or you find yourself that you want to do something, but once you start doing something, then you have stuff coming up. In fact, you know what, Tom, let me talk about me and my saboteur. And the reason why the book with the African, the full book with the African goddesses and gods would be delayed by another book. because when I started the work on the first book with the African goddesses, and you know, everything was right, I'd done all my homework to actually produce this, I heard my saboteur came out. And first of all, my saboteur did this, goes, "Hey, you're not really qualified to write this book." So my saboteur starts to speak to me and goes, "You're not qualified to write this book, because if you look, remember part of the homework of working around my book, I had to do some research. And when I researched people that had written books on goddesses and gods, some of them had more letters after their name than the Greek alphabet."
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes up. Then the saboteur goes, you're not worthy. Come on. These people who have these books out, they have PhDs, they have masters. Their masters have PhDs. Come on, you are not qualified for this. And then I'm like, okay, but I don't need to listen to this. So I put that voice aside. I go, come on, I'm a byproduct of personal development. I know I've done the events where I come out and I'm chanting hallelujah and I'm clapping and I come out and my self-esteem is great. Then my saboteur goes away and it transforms. It hangs out with a shapeshifter and it transforms and it comes back with a whole new guise and goes, "Well, I know you want to write this book, but really, do you really think you're acting good enough? I mean, your writing skills are not really that great. Remember in high school, your teachers told you that you were loud, that you write loudly. You're a great orator, but you are just loud when it comes to writing. People will not be able to understand you. You will be so embarrassed to write this book." And I'm like, And so the saboteur comes, and it keeps coming back. And I remember I was so frustrated when I had that conversation with you. And then I'm sitting back and thinking, and I realized that I need to have that personal conversation with my saboteur to realize and listen to what they want me to be aware of.
Okay, so here's the thing, right? And this is a good example of how you can use knowledge of the archetypes for a real world application, right? So here you've got you with this fantastic knowledge, right? And you bump into this guy who's the trickster, who's kind of tricked you. I'll be honest with you now. I'll be honest with all these people listening. I tricked you into writing the book, okay?
Yes.
Using Esu's cloak, right? So now I've been honest with you about that, and it got us so far. What other mantle and cloak could I adopt that would then allow you to respond in a different way? I'm not going to say in a better way. I'm just going to say in a different way.
Well, you've used a trickster, and there's also the aspect of you come back and you use your creator side, because that's essentially part of your archetype, because you create. Now, I'm going back into my host role. For everyone that doesn't know, Tom actually works with authors to produce their books, and Tom actually creates a lot of apps and products. So in his psyche is the creator, where he likes to produce things into reality, and that also flows into part of his alchemist side, where again is transforming things from one thing into another. So because of that, you're using your creator influences and saying, "Well, you can create this because you can get to change this." And during that conversation, you're like, "Well, why don't you just change the way you're responding to your saboteur? And since your saboteur is showing up in this way, why don't you discuss your saboteur so that people can relate to it?" And you gave me that room to see that even though the saboteur was bringing what I call the destroyer aspect, feeling like it was destroying my chance of actually completing this project, you were making me see that even though the destroyer was present, it was necessary for me to get past what the saboteur was doing and what the saboteur was saying. And for me to see that past the destruction, past that, comes clarity and saying, okay, this is what's left.
Gotcha. So what I'd do then, I'd create an idea for a book review. Still have the same content. So, you know, none of the work you've done to date is wasted. It would have the same content, but I'd be so creative that you'd be really happy to write it without having the letters after your name.
Yes.
And this is what I write, because I haven't got any letters after my name, you might notice. In fact, the only qualification I've got is a degree in electronics, which is not really the best degree necessarily. if you're going to be writing books about creativity and inspiration, or maybe it is, right? But we'll discuss that another time. So I'll just be creative then about how this book will be so in your comfort zone that one, you'll write it, and two, when people read it, they'll read it knowing you're in your comfort zone when you wrote it, and there was no stress going on, because people pick up on the author's emotions at the time they read it when they read a book. Yeah.
And so with that, what I will be doing is I'm going to simply write the book from the perspective of bringing in the 12 houses. And so we're going to be discussing what I call the 12 houses of the sun and the dark side of the moon.
Gotcha. Wow, you know so much stuff. This is another radio show.
Yes. So, yes, we're going to be doing all of that. And, you know, so when we discuss the 12 houses, we look at all the different archetypes and we break them down and we introduce them in different ways, from using the gods as a good example, using Disney cartoons, why the coward is not bad for you, and all of those things in cartoons. And because I'm a child, a byproduct of cartoons anyway, that's exactly what I want to talk about, and getting people to see that in cartoons there's a lot more to it and so much more levels for us to look at, that we can actually see our lives in such a great way.
So you take Tom and Jerry, because in Tom and Jerry, I think there are only four characters I know of. Tom, Jerry, and then that big dog, I mean, the dog called Buster. And then you've got the woman, where you never see her head, you just see her legs coming in.
Yes.
How does it pan out in Tom and Jerry?
Well, the woman is always the damsel, because once she sees Jerry, she jumps on the chair, and she's, Thomas! But then she goes into her warrior mode, or her Amazon mode, when Tom offends her, and she basically whacks Tom and chases him out of the house. And Jerry is, first of all, he's a thief and a trickster, and he actually operates so many different archetypes, because he's also a hero. Because I don't know if you've ever seen the one where they were in France, and they were supposed to be the time of the Musketeers. Mm-hmm. And Jerry takes on Tom, and he's part of the Musketeers, and he's training his little nephew on being a Musketeer, and honor and nobility and everything. And Tom is just basically the evil villain standing in the way of Tom and his true love, who is the princess. And again, the princess is an archetype of her own. And so all of those things, and this is what I spend a lot of my time doing, is watching it and actually being able to pinpoint these now. But it was such, it's funny, because when I, as a child, whenever I watch cartoons, I tried to leave the living room before the cartoon ended, because my dad was always, "And what did you learn?" And now I realize this is what I've actually learned from all the cartoons that I watched.
What a father you had.
Yes.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. So you were born for this work, it sounds like.
Actually, you know what? Yes, I am. I was born to do this, because I've been reading up on archetypes and watching it and, you know, imagine it. I mean, even in my own childhood, I can actually tell you, you know, I've talked about the saboteur side of me, but I had so much evidence coming up. In my childhood, when I made up stories, I was always the princess. But I wasn't the princess who was locked in a tower waiting for the knight to rescue her. I was always the princess who basically had the key to rescue her kingdom. I was either the mythical princess who used spells and this and that and would defeat the dragon, and which actually didn't surprise me, because I was looking through, you know, having a conversation with a friend, and I remember that in my friends, in the circle of friends that I had, even though I was the smallest one, I was always the one who was the avenger and the protector. I was always the one who would step up and protect my friends, even when they got into fights that they shouldn't have. They would run back to me to protect and avenge and fix their problems. And at that time, I was practicing the ancient art of, negotiation called kick your butt. Now I've learned to negotiate and mediate in a different manner.
Wow. So basically, as well as we pay attention, then the most unlikely characters that appear in our lives are just the archetypes that we need at that particular time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and sometimes we think, well, I don't need this to show up. I don't need the story to show up. Well, it's not about what you want. It's about, you know, you know, we think, I don't want this to happen. And I have to get people to understand it's not about what we want. It's about what we need. Because, you know, sometimes we need our mother inside to show up. And Amber is actually listening to the call. And because I've had some conversations with Amber, I know that part of Amber is, you know, she is basically the great mother. She is Yemiya. She's Isis. She's Iris. She's Hera. She's Oya and Ocean. She is a mommy. She's mommy to everybody. And, you know, that shows up as part of her aspect. So there are all of those things that come up, and not because we want them to, it's because we need them at that time. I just have a question that's come in, Tom, on Yahoo. Someone wants to know, when can we look forward to reading my book?
Well, let's just put it out there now. Let's say when it's going to be out.
Well, we are looking for it to be out and people to read. I would say, December. That's a good time.
December. Let's make early editions available for Christmas, 2011.
Yes.
Great. Now, listen, I think we've only got about 3 minutes left, haven't we? So let me ask you, how does it feel now to have been on your own show as a guest? How does that feel?
I would say it's been fun. It's been fun, and it's been very weird because it's, you know, part of me, the queen side of me, like, I'm supposed to be in control here. I'm supposed to be making sure everything's working, but I had to let that part of me move aside to allow you to take control and for me to be in my goddess self and my other archetypes of my storyteller self to be able to tell my story and fully elaborate that. So I thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Right. So listen, would you come back then? Lillian, would you come back on the Lillian show again?
Yes, I will.
That's great. And then just mapping this back into what we've been saying for the last hour, this is a good example of us flipping our archetypes, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So, you know, the version of Tom that you got when I was a guest, that's kind of been suppressed so that the goddess Lillian can really shine, yeah? And that's a good example for everybody how we can change the way that we are to get a different result.
Exactly. It's you know, if we look at it like a dance and we learn to the dance that the other person is doing and we learn to keep in step, we'll always be in harmony with somebody else.
Brilliant. Well, listen, do you want to just tell you a little bit about what's happening next week? Oh, next month? Is it next month or next week? Sorry, I don't know if it's monthly or weekly.
Oh, next week, as in next week Wednesday?
Yeah, no. I wonder what the next show was going to be about. You know.
Yes, we are going to be having a show. Actually, we're going to be taking a break in August, and we're going to be coming back in September. And in September, I'm going to be having so many amazing guests. I'm going to have Carlita Martin, who was one of the first Black female teachers in the UK. Mm-hmm. And we're going to also have Caroline Ariwa, who is a healer, a trainer, and basically a yogi based in the UK here. So we're going to have quite a few guests coming up in the show. And we might have a few mystery guests. And one of them is going to be a musical guest she has been in music, you know, in soul music for a very long time, and she was one of the pioneers of that whole Motown era. So I am so looking forward to actually interviewing her.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, listen, you've been a great guest. I've really enjoyed having you on my show temporarily today. Big hug down the line to you, and I'm so thrilled that I'm meeting not only you, but Amber next week in the flesh, which is fantastic. We're going to have a very fun day out. That's going to be really good. And it's been great. I mean, an hour's not enough to find out about this topic, and I, for one, want to read this book when it's out, that's for sure.
All right. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to getting it completed, and a lot of people can have some preview copies once the book is ready. And I'm looking forward to doing this again. And also, Tom and I, well, actually, Tom will be featuring in some of my workshops in 2012.
Yeah. And in the meantime, if anyone wants to know about their archetype, they can give you a call, and you can
see if
anywhere in the world is right over Skype, yeah?
Yes, if they're anywhere in the world, they can connect with me on Skype, which is Lillian, that's LILLIANOG01, connect with me on Skype, or they can look for me under Waking Passions fan page and connect with me on Facebook as well.
Great. And what's the website for everybody who's listening?
Well, my website, the websites are all in progress at the moment, but the link is under goddesstheories.com, and they can actually connect with me there. You can drop me a message, still drop me a message, at goddesstheories.com. You can look for me under Facebook as well, under my full name, which is Lillian Obogo, and I'll spell that, which is LILLIANOGBOGOH. So you can find me on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter as well. The Goddess Theories is on Twitter as well. But while the website is in progress, do contact me on Skype, and we can have a consultation there.
Brilliant. Well, you've been a fantastic guest. I really enjoyed talking to you tonight. It's been fantastic. And can't wait till you come back on, it's not my show, but the show again.
I can't wait. It will be fun to do it.
And thanks for listening, everybody, and I hope I'll be on the show again sometime soon, too. So speak soon, and take care, everybody.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom.